Chapter 1. My Journey. I have practiced, taught, and researched meditation for almost 50 years. If you were to ask me how that has had an impact on my soul, I'd have to say it's been bittersweet. Don't get me wrong, the sweet part totally trumps the bitter. Meditation has been very good to me. It has vastly deepened my sensual fulfillment and allowed me to see that my happiness need not depend on conditions. It has given me a new way to view myself and provided me with a set of tools for refining my behaviors and improving my relationships. Yes, sweet. But the icing on the cake is that every day I get to see people's lives change as the result of things I share with them. Often those changes are dramatic. People get to live their lives on a scale 2 to 3 times bigger than they otherwise would have been. That's a large claim, but the mechanism is quite simple. Meditation elevates a person's base level of focus. By focus, I mean the ability to attend to what's relevant in a given situation. By base level, I mean how focused you automatically get in daily life when you're not making an effort to be focused. If you're consistently 2 or 3 times more focused in each moment of life, then you're living 2 or 3 times bigger, 2 or 3 times richer. 5 decades ago, some very kind people in Japan slipped me the secret. You can dramatically extend life, not by multiplying the number of your years, but by expanding the fullness of your moments. Knowing that I had lived with such richness makes the visage of my inevitable death less problematic. That's the sweet part. So what's the bitter part? It is that most people will, in the end, not allocate the modest amount of time and energy required to do that. I live with the knowledge that most people will never have what they so easily could achieve. I know that the demands of daily life will convince them that they cannot set aside even a few moments to develop the one skill that will make it possible for them to optimally respond to those demands. The phrase, "What's wrong with this picture?" comes to mind. But once again, don't get me wrong, I'm not bummed out. In fact, I'm rather optimistic about the future. I explain why in the last chapter of this book. Although we may never meet in person, I feel subtly connected to you through these pages. Whether you have a meditation practice or not, the mere fact that you're interested in a book like this means that you've come a long way. Welcome. I call what I present here a science of enlightenment. By science, I mean an experiment that is reproducible by anyone. Meditation is something that human beings all over the world have been doing for a long time. Done properly, under the guidance of a qualified teacher, the results are, to a certain extent, predictable. Science can also refer to a structured body of knowledge, which the path of meditation definitely represents. The other noun in the title is enlightenment. Defining enlightenment is notoriously tricky. Almost anything you say about it, no matter how true, may also be misleading. Having said that, here's a place to start. You can think of enlightenment as a kind of permanent shift in perspective that comes about through direct realization that there is no thing called self inside you. This is a very rough and ready definition. We might call it the executive summary. Notice that I'm not saying that there is no self, but rather no thing called a self. Of course, there is certainly an activity inside you called personality, an activity of the self. But that is different from a thing called the self. Meditation changes your relationship to sensory experience, including your thoughts and body sensations. It allows you to experience thoughts and body sensations in a clear and unblocked way. When the sensory experience of the mind-body becomes sufficiently clear and uninhibited, it ceases to be a rigid thing that imprisons your identity. The sensory self becomes a comfortable home, not a jail cell. That's why enlightenment is sometimes referred to as liberation. You realize that the thingness of self is an artifact caused by habitual nebulosity and viscosity around your mind-body experience. Confusingly, the experience of no self can also be described as the experience of true self or deepest soul. You can call it no self, true self, big self, elastic self, liberation, nature, or true love. You can call it whatever you want. The important thing is not so much what you call it, but to know why it's relevant to your life and how you can feasibly get there. That's the purpose of this book. Sometimes this realization happens suddenly. You can read about that sudden version in books like Philip Kaplow's classic, The Three Pillars of Zen, which contains numerous testimonials from people who experienced enlightenment quite suddenly. But in my experience as a teacher, enlightenment usually sneaks up on people. Sometimes they don't quite realize how enlightened they've become over time because they have gradually acclimatized to it. So the perception of self, what it is, how it arises, is central to the science of enlightenment. We'll be looking at this in detail in the course of this book. But for now, I'd like to make a few disclaimers about my definition of enlightenment. First, my definition represents the low bar. That is, it describes the minimum change needed to qualify. However, that doesn't mean it's the end of the journey. In point of fact, it is merely the beginning of the unfolding of the wisdom function within you. Second, there are some people who claim that enlightenment is fictional, an exaggeration, or a celestial height that mere mortals can never approach. Let me be clear. Enlightenment is real. Not only is it real, but it is something that can be achieved by normal human beings through the systematic practice of meditation. Can people get to that place without practicing meditation? Yes. But meditation makes it more probable that they'll get to that place. And meditation makes it more probable that they'll continue to grow optimally after they get there. In the course of this text, we'll look at some of the signposts along the path, as well as some of the potential pitfalls and how to avoid them. I hope to sensitize you to the issues that can arise and give you a practical understanding of how to proceed. Of course, none of this can substitute for getting personal guidance from a qualified teacher, but it will hopefully function as an inspiration, a supplement, and a guidebook. Third, I'm fully aware that enlightenment is a term with the potential to cause misunderstandings and even contention. There is some dispute in spiritual circles about whether enlightenment is something a teacher should even explicitly talk about, and whether it's a goal to be achieved, or something that already exists, or both. I'm familiar with these various viewpoints, and am sensitive to the concerns they represent. Philosophically, I'm fully prepared to argue for either side of such questions. But as a teacher, I feel it is my duty to take a stand and to teach from a certain perspective. Each perspective has its own characteristic hazards. The perspective I've chosen is to explicitly describe enlightenment and present it as a feasible goal for ordinary people. Spiritual practice is often described as a kind of path with recognizable stages, but such a practice as path paradigm can involve some pitfalls. In colloquial usage, the word path implies a starting point, a destination, and a distance separating the two. But if enlightenment means realizing where you've always been, then the distance between the starting point and the destination must be zero, contradicting the very concept of a path. Moreover, when we describe spirituality as a path, it immediately sets up all kinds of craving, aversion, confusion, and unhelpful comparisons. People wish they were at some other place on the path, and they struggle to get there. When we think about spirituality as a path, we create the idea of enlightenment as an object out there in the future, separate from ourselves. As teachers, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we describe a path to enlightenment, it leads to the aforementioned problems. If we fail to describe a path, people won't have motivation or direction, and they won't be sensitive to the benchmarks. They won't know how to make optimal use of signs of progress. They won't know how to recognize windows of opportunity when nature presents them. Thus, to teach about enlightenment is to mislead people. On the other hand, to fail to teach about enlightenment is also to mislead people. You might say that to be a teacher means being willing to take on some bad karma in the service of greater good karma. There's a Zen story about an enlightened teacher who was climbing a tree. He slipped and fell in such a way that he was able to bite onto a branch, but he couldn't reach it with his hands or feet. He was literally hanging by his teeth. Then from under the tree, a student asked him the question, "What is the essence of enlightenment?" The teacher knew the answer to the question, but in order to give it, he would have to open his mouth, in which case he would fall to his death. On the other hand, if he failed to give the answer, he would be shirking his duty to aid his fellow beings. This story is the basis of a koan, or Zen question. If that were you hanging from the tree, what would you do? The koan is intended for advanced students who are in the position of teaching. It deals with a central paradox that comes up whenever we attempt to describe a path to enlightenment. If you teach that there is a path, you subtly mislead people, so you're dead. If you don't teach a path, you fail to inform and encourage people, so you're dead. Either way, you're dead. What would you do? So to write a book like this represents a choice on my part, a choice to die in the line of duty. But how did I get involved in all this to begin with? Growing up. I was born in Los Angeles, California in 1944. My mother tells me that I was a difficult baby. Whiny, fussy, agitated, high maintenance. Many of my earliest memories center around three themes: great difficulty dealing with physical discomfort, utter inability to be around others who were in emotional discomfort, and a constant sense of agitation and impatience. If I physically hurt myself in any way, or if the room was too hot or too cold, or if I was ill, I would literally freak out. I can remember devising elaborate strategies to put off for as long as possible visits to the doctor, shots, and visits to the dentist, drilling. I simply could not abide pain of any sort. I was also inordinately impatient in school. I would watch the clock all day, longing for the hands to reach 3 p.m. when I could leave. I felt frightened and uncomfortable in social situations and had to leave the room if any adult was going through difficult emotions. A girl I knew in school, whose parents were close to mine, died suddenly. My parents went to visit the family, but I refused to accompany them. I simply had no idea what to do around people who were grieving. I did very poorly in school, which was a source of great consternation for my parents. If the concept of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder had existed in those days, I probably would have been diagnosed as having a severe case and been heavily medicated. To sum it all up, my genes and early conditioning predisposed me to be anti-meditative. At the age of 14, I developed a passionate fascination with Asian languages and the traditional cultures of the East. As a result, I began attending a Japanese ethnic school in addition to American public school. In 1962, I graduated from Venice High School, where I was a nerdy social outcast. In the same week, I graduated from Sawtelle Japanese Language Institute, where I was the class valedictorian. The institute wanted to showcase the Japanese-speaking white guy. My high school grades were not good enough to get me into college, but my Uncle Jack found out that even if you had bad grades, if you did well on tests that measured your potential for success in college, you could get admitted to the University of California system. I took the tests, did quite well, and was admitted to UCLA as a potentially gifted student. At UCLA, I majored in Asian languages and took my senior year in Japan as an exchange student. That year was one of the happiest times in my life. I was in paradise. In those days, it was uncommon for a foreigner to speak Japanese, but I could speak, read, and write like a native. I could open any door just by opening my mouth. I hardly attended my university classes at all. Instead, I spent most of my time exploring the culture. One of the things I got involved with was the Sencha tea ceremony. I was horrible at it, being by nature klutzy, antsy, and unfocused. But it was still a lot of fun, because almost all the other students were young, cute, kimono-clad girls. I felt like the sole thorn in a rose garden. My tea teacher must have sensed that I needed some remedial training in being an adult, so she suggested that I go to Manpukuji, a Zen temple in Kyoto, with which she had some connections. I spent a month at the temple. I didn't do any meditation, but I did hang out with the monks, talking with them and learning about Buddhist culture. They made a profound impression on me. I sensed that they knew about some sort of secret sauce, a way to be deeply happy regardless of conditions. And I sensed that they would willingly share it with me, but would never force it upon me. I would have to take the initiative if I wanted to experience it for myself. But I was not ready yet, given my intrinsically anti-meditative personality. Still, hanging out with the monks in Mampukuji did change me. I became fascinated with Buddhist ideas and culture, albeit from an academic perspective. Upon my return to the United States and my graduation from UCLA, I entered a PhD course in Buddhist studies at the University of Wisconsin. In the late 1960s, Madison was a wild scene, and I loved it. I participated in the riotous anti-war protests, got tear-gassed and clubbed by the city police, vastly improved my Sanskrit, studied Tibetan and Pali, and read the Buddhist classics in their original canonical languages. I spent my summer breaks in San Francisco, learning about pot and LSD. I was able to complete all my PhD coursework in just 2 years and was sent back to Japan to do research on my doctoral thesis. At that time, the University of Wisconsin had the largest academic program in Buddhist studies in the Western Hemisphere. The chairman of the program, Richard Robinson, was my mentor, idol, and role model. He was an awesome polymath who could pun in Sanskrit and Japanese in the same sentence. His specialty was Buddhist logic, the syllogistic forms used by Indian and Tibetan philosophers to refute the thingness of things based on reasoning similar to Zeno's paradoxes. During this time, two events occurred that profoundly altered the course of my life. One just before my departure to Japan, and the other about a year after. The Brownie Epiphany. As I mentioned, during my 2 years of graduate school, I spent my summers in San Francisco, being initiated into the drug-centered zeitgeist of Haight-Ashbury. One afternoon, my friends and I dropped acid and went to the movie Yellow Submarine. The next day, I was alone in a friend's apartment and decided to smoke some hashish. Then I got the munchies and began eating a delicious, chewy chocolate brownie. I really got into that brownie. For a few minutes, I entered a state of samadhi, extraordinary concentration, centered on the taste and tactile sensation of the brownie. I became so focused on the act of eating the brownie that everything else fell away. There was just the brownie. It was sweet and yummy, but I also noticed that it had interesting textural properties. There were holes in the brownie caused by gas bubbles, and around those holes, the cake was harder and more dense than in its other parts. As I bit into the brownie, I could clearly detect the diffuse texture of the cake, the dense envelope around the holes, and the nothingness inside the hole. I remember thinking, the holes taste as good as the cake. At that instant, the duality of existence versus non-existence passed away, and for a moment, I was thrust into a world of oneness. Something had shifted, dramatically. That shift did not immediately go away, even after I'd completely come down from the drugs. For about 2 weeks, I walked around in a magic world. Prior to that, the things I'd read about in my Buddhist studies seemed to me to be nothing but mythological ruminations and philosophical conjectures, elaborated by scholars with too much time on their hands. Now, for the first time, I realized that they were not just concocting speculations. They were trying to describe something that human beings actually experience. After a couple of weeks, the experience faded into a pleasant memory, but it left me with a permanent intellectual shift. I now knew that certain parts of the Buddhist tradition, which I'd been studying as philosophical concepts, were in fact direct descriptions of actual experience. At the time, I had no way to get back to that experience, but at least I knew for sure that there was something in Buddhism besides quaint culture, scholastic speculation, and superstition. Looking back now, with decades of experience under my belt, I understand exactly what occurred that day in the Haight. Such spontaneous, transient, micro-tastes of enlightenment are not uncommon. I suspect that they occur for many, perhaps even most, people. Typically, the experience happens without warning and without previous practice and passes after a few minutes or hours or days. In my present capacity as a meditation teacher, I'm frequently approached by people who've had such spontaneous experiences. Unfortunately, often well after those experiences have already faded for them. I do not understand exactly why such spontaneous experiences occur when they do, to whom they do. In my case, the drugs may have facilitated it, but they were not the central factor, because drug-based epiphanies vanish as soon as the drugs are metabolized, and my experience definitely did not vanish immediately. I'd give anything to know what occurs neurophysiologically when people have such spontaneous quasi-enlightenment experiences. The fact that unitive no-self experiences happen to people who have no meditative training or spiritual perspective indicates to me that enlightenment is in some sense natural and just waiting to happen. When we finally learn why they happen spontaneously, albeit transiently, to some people under certain circumstances, we will probably be able to foster an enlightened age on this planet. That's why I said that I'd give anything to know, from a scientific point of view, what happens in cases like my Brownie epiphany. On the other hand, although I don't know why such experiences occur spontaneously for some people, I definitely know why they fail to last for most people. There are several reasons for this. The first is that in general, people who do not meditate do not have high habitual levels of concentration power. When a unitive or no-self, big-self state arises, they lack the concentration power to zero in on it and maintain it in the center of their awareness. Second, even if the people have some concentration power, they usually lack the sensory clarity to track how selfhood arises and passes in real time. Third, most people do not have high levels of habitual equanimity. Equanimity is the ability to allow sensory experience to well up without suppression and to pass away without identifying with it. After a glimpse of no self, the old habitual self-self will re-arise. Without tracking skills and equanimity, people quickly re-identify with their former habitually patterned identity, and consequently, the unitive perspective fades. By way of contrast, if some level of cultivated concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity precedes a spontaneous insight into oneness, that insight can be held centrally in awareness through concentration. And when the old habitual self reemerges, there need not be a re-identification with it. This is the difference between peak experiences, such as my Brownie epiphany, and actual enlightenment. Enlightenment is not a peak from which you descend over time. It is a plateau from which you ascend, further and further as the months, years, and decades pass. Learning to pay attention. Once I completed my PhD coursework, all I needed to do to get my academic degree was write my dissertation. As my thesis topic, I decided to study the Shingon school of Japanese Buddhism. Shingon is a Japanese version of Vajrayana, similar in many ways to the practices that are central to Tibetan Buddhism. However, Shingon is not a direct import from Tibet to Japan. Rather, the Tibetan Vajrayana and the Japanese Vajrayana share a common ancestor in late Indian Buddhism. Interest in Tibetan Vajrayana practice was beginning to burgeon in the late 1960s, but virtually no Westerner had studied the tradition's Japanese version. It occurred to me that Shingon studies would be a perfect subject to make my academic specialty. The topic required familiarity with a wide range of languages: modern Japanese, classical Japanese, classical Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan, all of which I had studied. My plan was to go to Japan, study Shingon for a year or so, write my dissertation based on that study, and come back to the United States and find an academic position as the foremost Western scholar of Japanese Vajrayana. But as we shall see, things didn't work out that way. I arrived at Mount Koya, the center of Shingon Buddhism, with letters of introduction and a command of both the canonical languages and the doctrinal framework of Shingon. But when I asked to be taught more, I was literally turned away at the gate. The master with whom I wanted to study, Abbot Nakagawa, told me in no uncertain terms that Shingon practice was not an intellectual curio, but a path for transforming a person's consciousness and life. If I wanted to actually practice it, then I would first have to live in the temple doing menial tasks. After a while, if he felt that I was worthy, I could then be ordained as a monk. But he offered no guarantee that would ever happen. And even if he did ordain me, I would have to live as a monk for a time while he determined if I was worthy to receive the Shingon initiations. He also couldn't guarantee that would ever happen. The message was clear. It was his way or the highway. I would have to either pick some other topic for my dissertation or jump through Abbot Nakagawa's hoops. I'd been told that he was the last fully traditional Shingon master, and to learn from anyone else was to miss out on what old-school Shingon training was really about. I waffled back and forth on this. As you'll remember, I am by nature an agitated, impatient, and wimpy sort of guy. The prospect of the severe training involved in being a Buddhist monk in Japan was utterly daunting to me. But in the end, I decided to take up the abbot's challenge, because although I was still primarily interested in Shingon as an academic specialty, the brownie epiphany had convinced me that there was something valid and personally meaningful to be found in Buddhist practice. I made a momentous, life-altering decision. I moved into the abbot's temple, Shino-in. Every morning the monks would do a long chant, and I would join in. I set myself the task of memorizing the entire liturgy. After the chanting, I spent most of the day doing simple jobs around the temple, such as cleaning, washing dishes, raking the garden, and serving meals to guests. I found this regimen extremely difficult. Previous to this, I had spent my days in studying and reading. Doing menial labor was torture for me. I was bored and agitated, my attention constantly wandering into memory, planning, fantasizing, always thinking about how I could be understanding Buddhism better by studying. Why was I wasting my time washing floors and cleaning toilets? After a few months, I was at my wit's end, and probably would have bailed had it not been for a stroke of good luck. One day, I was watching a group of monks practice sumo wrestling, and they asked me if I wanted to try it myself. I stripped down and put on the distinctive loincloth of the sumo wrestler and started to fool around with them. They were all much bigger and heavier than I was. I felt like a chihuahua among German shepherds. Not only was I skinny and weak, but I was poorly coordinated to boot. The whole thing was pretty comical. Skinny white boy in a loincloth being pushed around by Japanese giants. We were all laughing and having a great time. Then I noticed an older monk watching us from the sidelines and laughing too. His name was Okamura Keishin, and he was the coach of the sumo club. We struck up a conversation, and I found out that, although he was a Shingon monk by lineage, he was connected with the so-called Kyoto school of Zen philosophy. He told me that he had a weekly Zen sitting group there on Mount Koya and suggested that I attend. When I started to sit with his group, he gave me the traditional initial Zen concentration practice of breath counting. He insisted that I sit in full lotus for the full hour of the practice, which was hugely painful. But after a few months, I started to notice something interesting toward the end of my sit. My breath would slow down spontaneously. My body would relax despite the pain. And miracle of miracles, the voice in my head would stop frantically screaming. It was still there, but more like an undercurrent, a whisper. I went to Okamura Sensei and said, "My meditation is becoming interesting." He said, "Oh, is that so? Interesting in what way?" I described to him the slowing of the breath, the relaxing into the pain, and the semi-quieting of the self-talk. He said that that was good, and that I was beginning to experience the very first stages of zammai, which is the Japanese pronunciation of samadhi. Of course, as a scholar of Buddhism, I was very familiar with the term, a generic one for concentration. I could tell you how to say it in a half dozen languages, although I had never experienced it. But now I knew firsthand what the term meant. Okamura Sensei told me that this experience would become deeper and deeper as I continued my practice. But then he said something that totally blew my mind. "You must try to be in this state at all times, even as you go about ordinary activity." I thought to myself, I can barely get a little taste of it after an hour of busting my buns, trying to count my breath. How can I possibly be in this state in day-to-day life? He then said something even more mind-boggling. As a general principle, any positive state that you experience within the context of silent sitting practice, you must try to attain in the midst of ordinary life. He explained to me that there is a natural progression of challenges to attain this. The first is to experience some degree of samadhi during formal sitting. The next is to experience it during simple tasks, like cleaning. Then to maintain it during more complex tasks, like cooking meals, serving guests at the temple, and so forth. The next level of challenge would be to stay in samadhi during small talk. The ultimate challenge would be to stay in samadhi while having important, emotionally charged social interactions with others. Finally, I got it! The menial tasks I had been assigned to around the temple were meant to be an exercise in meditation. Whether washing dishes or cleaning toilets, my job was to try to stay in samadhi. When my attention wandered from the activity, I was to bring it back over and over again to my task. By doing that, I should eventually be able to enter that same pleasant, focused state that I experienced while sitting. Suddenly, it all made sense. I stopped thinking of my jobs in the temple as a meaningless waste of time and began to see them as fascinating challenges. Everything shifted. How deep can I get this morning as I wash these dishes? How deep can I stay as I rake the sand? I also began to notice that it was relatively easy to enter samadhi during the morning chanting. It was natural to let the external sound of the chant replace the internal sound of my self-talk. A different kind of life. Eventually, I was assigned to teach some of the young monks English. Needless to say, it was very difficult to maintain the taste of samadhi during the complex activity of teaching, but I would still attempt to do so. During the break periods between the monks' English lessons, I would go off by myself for 10 or 15 minutes and attempt to reconnect to the concentrated state by doing a short sit. Then I would come back and see if I could maintain the taste of the concentrated state during the class. Usually I was unsuccessful, but just making the effort seemed meaningful. One day before break time, a monk handed me an envelope saying, "This letter came to the temple for you." The letter was from one of my fellow graduate students in the Buddhist Studies program at the University of Wisconsin. I went off by myself, opened the letter, and read it. Its contents shook me to the core. My friend informed me that our mutual idol and my personal role model, Dr. Robinson, had suffered a horrific accident in his home. A fuse had burnt out in his basement, and when he went down to change it, he had struck a match for illumination. He didn't know that a pipe was leaking, and the basement was filled with gas. When he lit the match, the gas ignited, turning him into a fireball. He suffered severe burns over most of his body, including his eyes, which were destroyed. He was hovering between life and death. They didn't know which way it would go. Even if he lived, he would be horribly disfigured and blind. In the end, he lived for about a month in agonizing pain, and then died. This turned my life upside down. Up to this point, I had devoted myself to the acquisition of information and the honing of my intellect. But so what if you know a dozen languages and possess an intellect the size of Wisconsin? It won't help a bit when you're facing such intensities of pain, terror, and grief. Dukkha, suffering, the first noble truth of Buddhism, hit me like a ton of bricks. Being in horrible physical and emotional pain could happen to me. In fact, probably will happen to me, if only toward the end of my life. And it can also happen to everyone I love or am invested in. Indeed, it already had happened to Richard. You'll recall that my earliest memories center around an absolute need to avoid physical discomfort and an inability to deal with negative emotions, such as fear or grief, within myself and especially within others. I imagined what it would have been like had I not been in Japan, but back in Madison, dealing with the emotions that my friends and colleagues were going through. I realized that I would simply have had to avoid the whole situation. I wouldn't have been able to visit Richard in the hospital or be with his significant others because I simply wouldn't have known what to do with the emotions. Then I imagined what it would have been like to be in his body, writhing in pain day after day. I would have been in abject hell. Between reading that letter and receiving the news of his death a month later, A deep shift occurred in my value system. My academic study of Buddhism, my transient glimpse of enlightenment in San Francisco, and the beginnings of tasting samadhi had intellectually convinced me that it was, in theory, possible to experience physical and emotional pain without suffering. My idol's horrific death convinced me emotionally that I must pursue this goal. That's how I transformed from an armchair academic to a committed monastic. Richard's accident and death occurred in the summer. That fall, Abbot Nakagawa approached me with a piece of paper upon which were written two Chinese characters, Xin and Zen. This Xin means truth, and Zen means goodness. The abbot asked me if Shinzen would be an acceptable monk name for me. I was stunned. He was agreeing to ordain me, and giving me a very heavy name. The name spanned the totality of spiritual practice, Xin, or truth, being the liberating wisdom piece, and Zen, or goodness, being the compassionate service piece. Moreover, the name spanned the history of the temple where I'd been living. The temple was founded by Prince Shinyo over 1,000 years ago. Famous in Japanese history, Prince Shinyo was the first Japanese person to attempt to visit the Western world, which in his age meant India. He wanted to study Vajrayana directly under Indian masters, as opposed to indirectly through Chinese converts. The Shin of my name is the first kanji character in Shinyo's name, and the Zen is the first kanji in the abbot's name, Zenkyo. In essence, the abbot was saying, "There's a lineage of masters who have lived here for 1,000 years. Take it back with you when you return to the U.S. I told the abbot that I didn't think I could live up to the name. He said, "I know that, but is it acceptable to you?" I stuttered, "Yes." Several months later, as winter approached and it was getting cold and uncomfortable, Abbot Nakagawa told me that if I wanted to be trained in traditional Shingon practice, he would allow it. But I would have to do it the old-fashioned way. I would have to do a solo retreat of 100 days in winter, most of the time with no source of heat, in complete silence other than occasional instruction from him, and with no meal after noon. With all that had happened, I felt that I was now ready for such an ordeal. My training began on December 22nd, the day of the winter solstice. The abbot had warned me that part of the old-fashioned way involved certain ascetical practices derived not from Buddhism, but from the shamanic tradition of Shinto, Japan's pre-Buddhist tribal religion. One of the most common methods that tribal cultures use to obtain visions of gods or spirits is through prolonged exposure to extreme hot or cold. In India, Hindus have the five fires practice. In North America, Native Americans have the sweat lodge and the sun dance. These involve heat. The traditional Shinto shamanic practice goes in the other direction. It involves cold, squatting under freezing waterfalls in winter, or standing in cold springs, or dousing your body with ice water, and so forth. Because Shingon is Vajrayana, the main meditation practice involves working with visualizations, mantras, and mudra gestures. You replace your self-image with that of an archetype. You replace your usual mental talk with the mantra of that archetype, and you take on the physical and emotional body experience of that archetype through making mudras, ritual hand gestures. If your concentration is good enough, your identity briefly shifts. You become that archetype. This gives you insight into the arbitrary nature of self-identity. The technical term for this practice is deity yoga, because you experience merging, yoga, that is, yoking, with a mythic archetype. My current way of teaching mindfulness is in part informed by this early Shingon training. I have people observe self in terms of inner mental images, mental talk, and emotional body sensation, the three sensory elements used in the Vajrayana deity yoga practice. I've created a hybrid approach. What I have people observe is derived from the Japanese Vajrayana paradigm. Self equals mental image plus mental talk plus body. But how I have people observe is derived from mindfulness, which has its origin in Southeast Asian Theravada practice. So in a sense, I have brought the abbot's lineage back, although probably not quite in the form that he was expecting. The visualizations, mantras, and mudras are woven together into the framework of a ritual invocation. The traditional basic training, known as Kegyo, involves doing three such invocations daily, with the abbot privately initiating you into how to do the ceremonies. The Shinto shamanic piece comes prior to each of the three ritual invocations, and the practitioner is required to do cold water purification. You have to go to a cistern filled with half-frozen water, break the ice on top, fill a huge wooden bucket, and then squat and dump the bone-chilling liquid over your naked body. It's so cold that the water freezes the moment it touches the floor, and your towel freezes in your hand. So you are sliding around barefoot on ice, trying to dry your body with a frozen hand towel. For me, this cold water purification was a horrific ordeal. Maybe being a thin-skinned Californian had something to do with it. I did notice, however, that if I stayed in a state of high concentration while I did it, my distress was noticeably lessened. On the other hand, as soon as my attention wandered, the suffering became unbearable. I could see that this whole training situation was a giant biofeedback device designed to keep a person in some degree of samadhi at all times. On the third day of this training, as I was about to pour the water over myself, I had an epiphany. It hit me with crystal clarity. I was faced with a trichotomy. The future forked into three branches. I could spend the next 97 days in a state of high concentration all my waking hours, spend them in abject misery, or give up and fail to complete my commitment. The choice was obvious. When I completed the 100-day training, it was the spring of a new year, and I had a new self. I had entered the crucible, or should I say cryostat, of the traditional Shingon training, and had come out a different person. From that time on, I was able to consciously experience the taste of high concentration whenever I wanted to. 100 days subtracted from my life were really a very small price to pay in order to live a totally different kind of life. Turned on to science by a Jesuit priest. I often say that my life's passion lies in exploring what may arise from the cross-fertilization of the best of the East with the best of the West. Meditation is the systematic exploration of nature from the inside, and the East has done better than anyone else. Science is systematic exploration of nature from the outside. It's what the West did best, at least between the 16th and 19th centuries.
In point of fact, science does not, in general, belong to any specific human culture. Yet it is also true that the foundations of current science were formed during 4 centuries of explosive growth that began in Europe with the Renaissance.
So it's fair to say that modern science had its origins in the West and is Europe's great gift to the world. How to develop meditative states systematically and reliably is India's great gift to the world. I've talked a bit about how I got involved in meditation. Now I'd like to say a few words about how I got involved in science. Like my interest in meditation, my interest in science was ignited during my years in Japan. After having lived as a monk there for several years, when I was about to return to the United States, I got together with my friend Father William Johnston, a priest living in Japan who was responsible for vastly broadening my intellectual horizons. As soon as we met, Father Bill began talking about an exciting discovery he had made. At the time, scientists were beginning to study brainwave changes and other physiological parameters associated with contemplative practice. Father Bill was a Jesuit, a religious order that has traditionally drawn its members from the intellectual elite of the Roman Catholic world. As a Jesuit scholar, the notion of using science to study mystical experience, the deepest and most important sort of spiritual experience, was utterly fascinating to him. Specifically, he was excited by 2 facets of this research. First, the research seemed to show that while the conceptual systems of the various religions, and specifically those of Buddhism versus Christianity, are very different, the underlying neurological correlates of contemplative adepts in those traditions are often rather similar. This lent credibility to the notion that the world's contemplative traditions can be viewed as a unity, an idea that I had already wholeheartedly embraced, and which I'll discuss more in Chapter 3. Even more exciting to Father Bill was the prospect that science could actually lend credibility to the reports of contemplatives. He was particularly interested in the results published by two researchers at Tokyo University, Japan's most prestigious academic institution. Their paper seemed to prove that some of the subjective experiences reported by meditators had a clear basis in objective physiology. Father Bill's spark of excitement ignited a bonfire in my mind. If science could provide evidence to confirm one effect of meditation, perhaps it could confirm other effects. More importantly, perhaps, it could discover new things about enlightenment that none of the greatest masters in the past had known. Deep, fundamental, important things. Perhaps science could even discover things about enlightenment that would make enlightenment attainable by large masses of human beings. Perhaps science could democratize enlightenment, as it had democratized other aspects of power, comfort, and convenience. This concept utterly changed my world. What had initially brought me to Japan was a fascination with the cultures of the East. In learning how to meditate, I felt I discovered the pinnacle, the highest thing that Asia could give me. Having directly experienced Asia's unique offering to the world, I asked myself, what next? Surveying the achievements of all world cultures, I saw one other pinnacle as high as the subjective science of the East, and that was the objective science of the West. Then and there, I decided what was next for me. I knew I would be spending the rest of my life in the practice and teaching of meditation. In parallel with that, I resolved I would study science, so that perhaps at some future time, when my Buddhist practice had deepened, I would be able to intelligently dialogue and collaborate with scientists, helping them to understand meditative states, and perhaps even how enlightenment comes about. That meeting with Father Bill changed the course of my life. And indeed, my intuitions in this regard have been dramatically confirmed. At the present time, in major universities all over the world, vigorous research programs exist aimed at turning the lens of science toward the experience of contemplative adepts. Much of this research involves an active collaboration between the adept and the researcher. Even more significant is the fact that many young neuroscience students are taking on a meditative practice, meaning that soon the research designer and the research subject may often be the same person. Discovering mindfulness. After returning to the United States, I lived for many years at the International Buddhist Meditation Center, IBMC, in Los Angeles. True to its name, each of the main historical forms of Buddhist practice is represented there. Mindfulness, Theravada, Zen, Mahayana, Tantra, Vajrayana. My ordination had been in Shingon, and I had some experience with Zen through Okamura Sensei. But now I currently prefer to teach within the framework of mindfulness. That shift occurred through interacting with mindfulness teachers who were living at the IBMC. Specifically, a young, mellow Californian named Bhante Rahula. Later, I sought out a number of prominent mindfulness teachers, such as Usilananda and Upandita from Burma, Bhante Punaji from Sri Lanka, Ajahn Sobhin from Thailand, and Bill Hamilton, an American with broad experience in the Mahasi tradition. I also attended numerous retreats conducted through the Goenka organization. Through these teachers, I became familiar with the two major lineages of contemporary mindfulness, or vipassana, as it is often referred to in Asia: the Mahasi lineage and the Ubakin lineage. From the Mahasi tradition, I learned the power of the noting method. From the Ubakin tradition, I came to appreciate the importance of body sensation in the process of psychospiritual growth. There are two reasons why I currently teach within the framework of mindfulness. The first is that mindfulness is the least culture-bound of the three Buddhist practice traditions. It is relatively easy to extract it from the cultural and doctrinal matrix within which it arose, and to present it as an evidence-based, secular, and culturally neutral process. The second reason is that the general method of mindfulness shares some features with the general method of modern science. I like to describe mindfulness as a threefold attentional skill set: concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity working together. These three components in some way parallel three important facets of the scientific method. A scientist makes progress through focused investigation of an important question for as long as required. Although it's not quite the same as the meditator's real-time focus, there is perhaps a loose analogy here. One aspect of clarity that is developed in mindfulness is the ability to detect and resolve the subtle details of our sensory states. This parallels how scientists use high-resolution, awareness-extending tools, microscope, X-ray diffraction, and so forth, to reveal the subtle infrastructure of the physical world. Another aspect of clarity developed in mindfulness is deconstruction, or component analysis. We take a complex sensory event, such as selfhood, and break it down into its natural components, its atoms, so to speak. This parallels the way a scientist or mathematician would break down a complex system into manageable parts, atoms, primes, basis vectors, and so forth. Finally, in mindfulness, we practice equanimity, a gentle matter-of-factness with whatever comes up in experience. In a similar way, a scientist is trained to maintain the detached viewpoint of a neutral observer. For many years, I maintained a two-pronged learning regimen, studying mindfulness with Asian and Western teachers, while simultaneously studying science on my own. My goal was to deeply integrate the power of those two worlds within one person. But I still felt a lack. I longed for contact with a teacher whose experience was vastly senior to my own. Zen again. On Mount Baldy, near Los Angeles, was a Zen master named Joshu Sasaki Roshi. He was without a doubt the senior Zen master living in the United States, and arguably the senior living Buddhist master in the world at that time. He started his practice in a monastery at the age of 13 and died at the age of 107. You do the math. I studied with Sasaki Roshi for many years. I don't think I have the personality type to be a very good Zen student. I am much more attracted to the systematic, if somewhat prosaic, style that characterizes Vipassana, mindfulness meditation. I did, however, learn several hugely important things from Sasaki Roshi, some of which I might not have learned if I had practiced solely within the mindfulness context. For one thing, I learned that impermanence is not merely something that you experience in your sensory circuits. It also informs your motor circuits. It's a kind of effortless energy that you can ride on in daily life. It imparts a bounce to your step, a flow to your voice, and a vibrancy to your creative thought. I also learned about the expansion-contraction paradigm for how consciousness works. That paradigm, described in Chapter 10, informs the core of the way I teach. Moreover, through contact with Roshi, I learned the importance of not suppressing the arising of self. I describe this insight in Chapter 8. Finally, he provided me with a role model around devotion to teaching, an example of seemingly endless availability and service to students. For all of that, I'm eternally grateful. On the other hand, a few years ago, I was shocked to discover that Sasaki Roshi had engaged in some questionable behaviors. People have been terribly confused and understandably upset by those revelations. How could a highly enlightened person do such things? We would like to think that enlightenment is a unity that grows in a uniform way, but actually, it is a many-dimensional process. Usually growth in one dimension facilitates growth in the others, but not inevitably. Sometimes a person can become stunningly proficient with regard to certain dimensions of spiritual empowerment, while under-emphasizing other aspects. In my way of thinking, the ultimate reason to experience liberation is to better serve others, and a sine qua non for effectively serving others is to be a decent person by the ordinary canons of society, or as my father would have put it, a mensch. Freedom should be manifested within clear ethical guidelines and an egalitarian feedback structure. Informed by the spirit of science. I currently divide my time between teaching meditation and designing research related to meditation. I characterize my approach to teaching meditation as informed by the spirit of science. One aspect of that is my use of metaphors. As you will find in this book, I derive great joy from discovering parallels between situations that come up in math and science and situations that come up in meditative experience. Another aspect of informed by the spirit of science comes out in how my students and I use language. I attempt to define things very carefully and insist that language be used precisely and rigorously. One of the things that you learn if you delve into the physical sciences or mathematics is a habit of precision in expression and thinking. For example, in ordinary colloquial English, the words energy, potential, power, and force sound sort of similar. We might use them interchangeably on occasion. But in physics, each one of these words means something completely different and distinct. Each one is defined very carefully, and in many cases, it took centuries for that precision of language to be honed and perfected. An example from mathematics, which you would learn in a beginning calculus course, is the definition of derivative of a function. Initially, the definition seems quite complicated and subtle, and you have to read it over and over until it finally registers. I had to read it dozens of times before it appeared natural and obvious. If you're interested, you'll find a reader-friendly definition in Wikipedia under derivative mathematics. What they don't tell you in your beginning calculus book, and what would have helped me a lot had they told me, is that the modern textbook definition of the derivative is not the one that Newton, the inventor of calculus, used. The modern definition is the result of contributions from generations of the finest mathematical minds in the world. 2.5 centuries of confusion, discussion, and contention on the topic separate Newton's first formulation from what appears in the modern textbook. No wonder it seems subtle, and you have to read it over and over again until it finally registers. So in math, you get used to speaking in a precise, careful way. You realize that you're going to really have to think about the definitions, and that you're going to have to read and reread. But it's going to be totally worth it. An ordinary high school student who is willing to come back to the definitions and read them over and over again will be able to understand calculus more clearly than its inventors, because the wisdom of many generations of mathematicians is stored in the current pithy definition. That spirit of precision informs the way I teach. My system requires people to master some carefully defined technical vocabulary and to acquire the ability to say what you mean. I like to think of myself as being on a mission to take the mist out of mysticism. I have a good general knowledge of science and math, but I have a professional, academically trained knowledge of comparative mysticism and Buddhist studies. The scientific exposure causes me to be somewhat fussy with regard to how my students use language. Some people find this aspect of my teaching difficult at the beginning, but it saves them a lot of time in the end. It allows people to conceptualize and communicate the entire path to classical enlightenment using a precisely defined technical vocabulary. That's what I mean by taking the mist out of mysticism. Another influence from mathematics and science involves the notion of generality. You are probably familiar with the term general relativity. Within the context of math and science, general means broad or universal. Mathematicians and scientists usually try to discover the broadest possible unifying vision. General relativity covers more cases than special relativity. I have applied that principle to the teaching of meditation by creating a universal grid for classifying meditation techniques. Each of the major innovations within the history of world meditation has a natural place on that grid. Furthermore, I have reformulated each of those innovations in modern, secular language and expressed it within the unifying framework of mindfulness. I've used that framework to design mindfulness research projects at numerous institutions, such as Harvard Medical School, Carnegie Mellon University, and University of Vermont. One result that I'm particularly pleased with is a breakthrough piece of research that Dr. David Vago and I have been conducting at Harvard Medical School since 2010. The research for our first publication, Neurobiological Substrates Underlying Varieties of Restful Experience, utilized my distinctive periodic table of sensory events. At Harvard, We are currently investigating automated mindfulness software as an aid to psychotherapy. This is based on an app that was developed by me, David Cresswell, and Emily Lindsay at Carnegie Mellon University. In this clinical study, therapists prescribe an app-based interactive mindfulness tutorial that systematically trains their clients in attentional skills, concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity. We're testing the hypothesis that this might dramatically potentiate positive therapeutic outcomes. Interesting times.